Welcome to the Morning Mix. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with guest co-host Dr. Andy Lee Roth. Peter Phillips will be back next week. Today's topic is on the Fukushima Daiichi disaster and the various continuing concerns that linger. Our first interview is with Yastel Yamada, president of the Skilled Veterans Corps of Fukushima, and Cecil Pineda, author of the new book, Devil's Tango. The second half of the show today, we'll interview Dan Seith, CEO of International Medcom, who's currently working with Japan to monitor the spreading Fukushima radiation, and Brian Covert, author of On the Road to Fukushima, a chapter in the censored 2013 book. Welcome to the Morning Mix. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Dr. Andy Lee Roth, our guest co-host today in studio. Peter Phillips is off today. He'll be back next week. Today's topic for the hour, we look at the unfolding catastrophe that is Fukushima Daiichi. At Project Censored, we've certainly reported about this nuclear catastrophe since its inception, and we continue to do so because there's still a lot that isn't being widely discussed, certainly not in the corporate media in the United States. We are honored today to be visited by Yastel Yamada, who is the co-founder of the Skilled Veterans Corps for Fukushima, SVCF. This is composed of retired nuclear workers, engineers, construction workers, and others volunteering to work in the high radiation environment of Fukushima Daiichi to stabilize the decommission and decommission the plant so younger workers don't have to be exposed to radiation. Yastel Yamada joins us in studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
We are also joined by Cecil Pineda. She has been an anti-war activist from early life. More than ever, she has turned her attention to issues affecting the sustainability of the planet. Her recent book, Devil's Tango, How I Learned the Fukushima Step by Step, has been called a tour de force, and Jeff Biggers of the Huffington Post said it was one of the most important and required reads this year. Cecil also joins us this morning in studio. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thanks so much again for taking your time. Yastel, let's begin with you, Yastel Yamada.
Yes.
Tell us about the Skilled Veterans Corps for Fukushima.
Yeah, SVCF is formed in April last year, just 1 month after the earthquake at Fukushima Daiichi. And we have now 680 members, but we requested to work at the site, but Japanese government and TEPCO doesn't accept yet.
So TEPCO is the Tokyo Electric Power Company, and so you're saying that TEPCO and the Japanese government are not accepting offers of your group?
They say that they welcome the SVCF, but at this moment they don't need. Well, they don't have the room to accept us.
Could you tell listeners a little bit more about SVCF? That's the Skilled Veterans Corps for Fukushima. Could you tell us how did this start, and then what exactly is the purpose?
The purpose is that the Fukushima Daiichi is very much contaminated with radioactive materials, as you know, and working at the site, the younger people should be exposed with radiation. It makes a serious problem in the future. But elder people like us does have the much less risk exposed by the radioactive material.
So SVCF is a group of retired nuclear workers, engineers, construction workers, and you're saying that because you are older, that you're essentially, what you're saying is you're sacrificing yourselves for the future generation.
Not a sacrifice. Now we can reduce the risk as a human beings.
Mm-hmm. Andy Roth here, and I want to turn to Cecil Pineda, author Cecil Pineda. Your latest book is, of course, Devil's Tango, as Mickey introduced, and it's won some high accolades from folks like Jeff Biggers, Joanna Macy, John Nichols and others. But I want to ask you as an opening question, Cecile, can you tell us some about, more broadly, the reception that Devil's Tango has had? How has it been represented in the media?
There has been absolutely no print attention whatsoever. And that's very critical because there's been absolutely no coverage in any of the journals that librarians use to make book purchasing decisions. And such as Publishers Weekly, Library Journal, Kirkus, and Booklist. But, demand has been voracious once people know that the book exists. I completed a tour of the Northeast recently and made some 15 appearances in 9 days. And during that time, 500 books flew off the shelves. So there have been electronic reviews. One of them you just mentioned, Jeff Biggers in the Huffington Post. Counterpunch, Harvey Wasserman has reviewed it in Counterpunch. And various bloggers, particularly there's a very good review at Went to, that's numeral 2, The Bridge blogspot.
So what do you think is, what's to account? There's obviously something in the book that is creating this disjuncture between popular interest in what the book reports and the lack of corporate coverage for the book. How would you explain that?
I think that two of your major outlets essentially are connected to the nuclear industry. And so it is very much in their interest to suppress any coverage that has to do with the bright and shining myth that nuclear is good for you. So in addition to the meltdowns at Units 1, 2, and 3 in Fukushima, there are a series of spent fuel pools which are, if anything, even more threatening. And these reactors are GE Mark 1s, and they were sold by GE knowing that they were defective. The cooling pool is located 100 feet up, that is in the attic. The bathtub is in the attic. And the water must be circulated for all eternity to cool the fuel rods. Otherwise, expect a hydrogen buildup and explosion. And that, of course, ruptured containment. And then, of course, there's Unit 4. I think in the kinds of presentations that I've been making in public, it's very hard for people to understand the magnitude of this accident. So I asked them how many of them had a look at either their television screens or their computers at the time of the BP oil spill, and they could see all this stuff spewing from the seafloor. Now imagine what a meltdown looks like. It's impossible, of course, to see, but essentially the same thing is going on. We just don't have a camera there, so we have to use our imaginations, and most people don't have that. But I think that we can safely say that we've gone past the point where we can control our own technology. That was true with the BP oil spill, and I think that is even more demonstrably true now. I think that Fukushima Daiichi is now the most catastrophic industrial accident that we have ever suffered in the world. And TEPCO, as Mr. Yamada will explain and will expound, is a utility company. It doesn't have the expertise in remediation, but it's secretive and unaccountable and refuses any help.
Yostel Yamada, what about that? Could you tell listeners a little bit more about TEPCO? You mentioned earlier that the Japanese government and TEPCO were really preventing your group from helping and your expertise. Could you tell us more about this and some of the secrecy swirling around?
TEPCO is the operating company that just making the electricity and delivering, and they are not a construction company. It's very hard to contain and clean up the Fukushima Daiichi. And there is a multi-layered subcontract system. Then TEPCO cannot manage the actual site work. That is a serious problem. Therefore, they cannot accept us.
And Yostel Yamada, it's true. You're going to be at Bioneers this afternoon. Is that correct?
At 2:45.
2:45
today. Both of us going to be on a panel, yes.
Okay, and that also, Yostel Yamada, you're going to be in the Newman Auditorium at Santa Rosa Junior College this evening.
Yes.
That's at 7 p.m. So folks in the Bay Area, you have a couple of opportunities here to go and see a panel this afternoon at Bioneers, 2:45, and also to see Mr. Yamada this evening at Santa Rosa Junior College. Mr. Yamada, again, could you go into some more detail about the actual experiences that you've had and what you've seen?
That, you mean that about the nuclear power?
Yes.
I myself doesn't have any experience for the nuclear power. I'm just a general engineer and having some experience about the plant construction. And I, from viewpoint of such a project manager, I seeing the TEPCO does have the serious problem.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that the Skilled Veterans Corps for Fukushima has argued, as I understand it, is that there needs to be an international effort to stabilize the plants. Why do you argue that the effort, the cleanup effort, should be international? What are the problems with the government's own cleanup effort?
Japan, of course, had the first experience about this accident. And there are two big accidents about the nuclear power in Three Mile Island, Chernobyl. And we have to speed up. And the good work at the site, therefore, we need the collaboration of the experienced people.
Mm-hmm. And what about the government's own efforts? There's some evidence that the government is actually collaborating with as many as 400 private companies. Is that a good thing in your opinion, or is that problematic?
It's problematic. And the 400 company doesn't mean that it's so much. There are, say, 2,000 or 3,000 workers at the site, and those workers are covered by the 400 companies. It means that one company has less than 10 in average. It's so much splitted and not integrated project management can done. That is a problem.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on the Morning Mix. I'm Mickey Huff with Dr. Andy Lee Roth. This morning's topic, we're talking about the nuclear power disaster at Fukushima Daiichi. We're joined by Yostel Yamada, Skilled Veteran Corps for Fukushima, and we're also joined by Cecile Pineda, author of Devil's Tango. Cecile, back to you. You mentioned versus the British Petroleum ecocide disaster of the Gulf of Mexico, what happened and what is continuing to happen at Fukushima is the largest industrial accident in the world. And let's connect that to nuclear power, to nuclear war, the atomic age. Later on in the program, we're going to hear from Brian Covert, who talks about the road to Fukushima, how did we get there. But could you talk a little bit about the connections between nuclear energy and nuclear war?
Yes, absolutely. I just want to stress that Fukushima Daiichi has released more cesium into the planet's atmosphere than Chernobyl and all the many years of atmospheric testing ever did. And the effect on the DNA of all living creatures, not just people, but we're talking about plants and animals, and we're talking about the bacteria and the fungi that live in the rhizosphere. It distorts the DNA. It distorts the DNA's message to all living things. And for people that are exposed, whether they are downwinders or whether they are fabricating this stuff or working in these plants, it causes elevated cancers, leukemias, and catastrophic birth deformities. There's evidence that the DNA damage to DNA has caused already mutations in the birds and butterflies at Fukushima. There are also stillbirths and birth deformities, but there's no official record being kept. 30% of the children in the zone that has been refused by the government to evacuate are showing thyroid cysts and nodes. There is a connection between the energy and war-making aspects of the nuclear industry. Weapons-grade plutonium is produced by almost all nuclear reactors. It has to be reprocessed, but without the nuclear reactors, there's nothing to reprocess. At the same time, nuclear fuel is obtained from an enrichment process whose byproduct is uranium-238. And that's depleted uranium, but there's nothing depleted about it. It's million times more damaging even to DNA than uranium-235. Japan, and this is very key, Japan has a reprocessing plant designed to extract weapons-grade plutonium from spent fuel. It's called Rokkasho. And Rokkasho has been called by one Japanese nuclear expert the dirtiest factory on Earth. The U.S., on the other hand, has phased out its reprocessing facilities. And as a result, the U.S. depends very much on Japan for continuing its nuclear program. You may remember that Prime Minister Noda announced some 3 weeks ago that Japan would become nuclear energy free by 2030. Roughly a week later, he reversed that position 100% because the United States offered to install a missile defense base in Japan, and the U.S. depends on Japan to continue its own nuclear energy industry just because Japan has Rokkasho. And by installing a missile defense shield in Japan, it, of course, can begin serious efforts to contain China, which is a euphemism for encirclement. So that's basically a summary of what is going on politically now in Japan.
So, Cecile, let me follow up on that then. In this context of U.S. dependence on Japan for its, that is, the United States, nuclear programs and interests. We hear very little about the state of popular protest in Japan. Can you inform us some about that and perhaps contrast it with what you found touring the country promoting Devil's Tango here in the United States?
The key event, I think, is when Prime Minister Noda, I believe in the month of June, gave Kansai Electric Company the go-ahead to restart the Oe reactors. That's when Japanese protest exploded. And every Friday night in Tokyo, just in Tokyo alone, and this is nationwide, but in Tokyo, 200,000 Japanese crowd the streets every Friday night to protest. And that protest occurs in other areas of Japan as well. And in order to do this, the Japanese people have had to overcome severe cultural restraints. This is absolutely not in the Japanese character. And many of these protesters are women, and that is absolutely unprecedented. Americans here, we also have cultural restraints. My feeling is that if the Japanese can overcome theirs, we also can overcome ours. I think that when I talk to my listeners, they ask me what kind of hope there is, because they see Unit 4 and its fuel pool as potentially very, very threatening to the biosphere, particularly if there is a continued accident. And in parentheses, I want to say that since the great Tohoku quake of 2011, which was a 9 on the Richter, earthquakes in Japan have occurred 25 times more frequently, and there's a geological reason for that. So essentially, we hang by a thread. But I, when I talk to my listeners, what I say is that we have an opportunity to see in this catastrophe an invitation, really, to become more human, if we can say it like that, to cherish everything that we hold dear with a kind of poignancy that until now, we don't seem to be able to feel very much. And at the same time, I think it is a call to become active in opposing the nuclear industry in all its death-dealing aspects, whether it's weaponry or whether it's energy. I just want to mention that the Vandenberg 15 case was just dismissed. These are 15 protesters, including Daniel Ellsberg, Cindy Sheehan, and others, who were arrested calling attention to a missile launch, which signals America's continued determination to develop more nuclear weapons.
Yestel Yamada, let's talk about that just briefly. We only have 2 minutes left in this segment. But we just heard about the protests in Japan and raising awareness and really overcoming adversity in many, many ways. Why tour the United States? Why are you touring the United States?
In Japan, we have found that the problem or difficulties for us is very, very basic social structure or industry structure, and it is not easy for the government or TEPCO to reform the contract system and so on. Therefore, I want to have the pressure from the outside, and also the Fukushima's problem is not only for Japan, it's a worldwide problem, and I would like to have the voices from United States, from other countries worldwide. That is main purpose to come to Japan, to United States, to talk to the people in USA.
Yestel Yamada, thanks so much for joining us and for your tour and your message, working with Skilled Veterans Corps for Fukushima. You will be with Cecile Pineda today at Bioneers at 2:45 p.m. Listeners can go to bioneers.org for information about that. That's in San Rafael, California, I believe, at the Marin Center. That's this afternoon at 2:45. Mm-hmm. Also, this evening, Yestel Yamada, you'll be at the Newman Auditorium at Santa Rosa Junior College at 7 p.m. That event is free. Cecile Pineda, we have about 15 seconds. Just wanted to give you the last word about how people can get involved.
I wanted to talk about how readers can get Devil's Tank, how I learned the Fukushima step by step. They can go to wingspress.com. That's wingspress, exactly spelt the way it sounds. It's also available in e-formats from your independent bookstores. And if you like the book, be sure to write a review on the Amazon Devil's Tango page and ask your local library to purchase some copies. They carry most of my other books, and they need to know that this book exists. Thank you so much for allowing us to speak to you this morning.
Cecile Pineda, Yestel Yamada, thanks so much for joining us on this very important,
thank you very much,
important issue. Please stay with us after this short musical break. We will continue with our theme on Fukushima Daiichi.
This is PRN.FM, the number one station for progressive minds.
Hi, it's me, John Mueller, host of The Expat Files, broadcasting twice a week from somewhere deep down in the heart of Latin America. The Expat Files is a show that explains what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. You can catch The Expat Files on Sundays at 11 a.m. and Fridays at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time, and of course in the archives. And don't forget, we'd like you to rate the show in iTunes. So whether you're interested in jumping off the first world treadmill or are just curious about Latin America, take it from me, a guy who's been down here 20 plus years. The Expat Files is tailor-made for you. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is Charlene Spretnak. I'm the host of All Together Now, a program about recent discoveries that human life is far more dynamically interrelated than modern society's thought. I hope you'll join me and my guests for All Together Now on Thursdays at 3 o'clock Eastern Time. If you can't catch the live broadcast, it's available in the archives at prn.fm. If you like All Together Now, please rate it at iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, this is Professor T. Love of A Bowl of Soul, a mixed stew of soul music. Come get your history lesson in soul music on Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. As I play soul music from 1949 to the present. Also, listen to A Bowl of Soul in the archives. If you like A Bowl of Soul, rate us in iTunes. Come and catch a groove on A Bowl of Soul. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Oh, Jeff.
Yes, Lane?
I just want you to know.
What?
You occupy my heart.
Aw.
Cheater on the Rude with Jeff Chrysler
and Lee Papa. Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern. Check out our old shows on the archives.
Archives? That sounds like some weird yellow moldy paper stuff.
And you can listen to all of our old moldy shows at PRN.FM.
Did you hear the Progressive Radio Network has a new slogan?
It does.
It does. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
That sounds sort of progressive.
It does, it does, but I think it needs to be a little more demanding.
Progressive Radio Network is moving forward,
and we
want
you
to
come
with us.
Hi, I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo.
We hope you'll join us in our new time slot for our live call-in talk show, Prescriptions for Health, on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com. Mondays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 a.m. Pacific Time.
Sometimes a fever's not a bad thing.
Dreaming is really important to our health.
Laughter's the best medicine.
We should use our common sense.
If you miss our live show, you can always catch the archives on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com.
And also, if you like our show, please rate us on iTunes.
The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is PRN.FM, your source for progressive radio that makes a difference.
Welcome back to the Morning Mix Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Dr. Andy Lee Roth. That was Vivaldi's Autumn. No, you're not listening to NPR. This is KPFA.org. We're going to continue our theme today on Fukushima Daiichi and the disaster, which continues to unfold there in Japan and also has global consequences. The censored 2013 book, Dispatches from the Media Revolution, that Andy Roth and I just recently completed, it's out this month from Seven Stories Press, has a couple of segments, actually, on Fukushima. Our top 10 stories, our top number 3, is all about problems surrounding censorship and underreporting in Fukushima, and we also have an entire chapter in the book later on in the Project Censored International segment called On the Road to Fukushima, the Unreported Story Behind Japan's Nuclear Media Industrial Complex. And joining us in our second segment, one of our two guests is Brian Covert, author of that chapter. We are delighted to be joined by Brian Covert, who is on phone from Japan. He's an independent journalist, an author based in Western Japan. He's worked for for UPI News Service. He's also a lecturer in the Department of Media, Journalism, and Communications in Kyoto, was it, at one time. Brian, are you with us?
I am. Good morning, Mickey.
Brian, thanks so much for joining us, and certainly thank you for your contribution to Censored 2013. We're going to talk about that. We're also joined by Dan Scythe, CEO, International Medcom, a manufacturer of radiation detection instruments and systems. He's been professionally designing Geiger counters for 33 years. He also helped set up radiation monitoring stations in Chernobyl and Three Mile Island, as well as other nuclear facilities to ensure that they were safe. Dan's currently working with Japan, folks in Japan, to monitor the spread of Fukushima contamination. And he's returning from Japan with updates on the disaster, and he joins us also this morning. Dan, are you with us?
Yeah, good morning. Good to meet y'all.
Thanks so much
for having me.
You're very welcome. Thanks for joining us, and I know our listeners are excited to hear more about what the two of you have to share with them. Brian Covert, let's begin with you, because you talk about the history of, you know, your chapter really, you know, spells it out. It says, on the road to Fukushima, the unreported story behind Japan's nuclear media industrial complex. Can you explain that?
Sure. Well, it just seemed to me as this whole thing was unfolding with Fukushima that the Japanese mainstream media and to some extent the American mainstream media were missing the bigger picture of the whole thing, which was how did we get to this place where Fukushima happened? And when we go back and look in time, it really, in a sense, makes sense how this all happened. You know, Japan was rising from the ashes of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Went through the Cold War period, but there was a lot of support from the U.S. for Japan's nuclear push. And, you know, it sounds kind of ominous to call it a nuclear media industrial complex, but that's really what it is. The media cooperated with the nuclear power industry from the beginning, from its inception back in the 1950s up until today. And that's all part of Japan's kind of economic miracle that occurred after World War II. So the media in Japan is fully integrated into the nuclear complex in Japan. And I would go so far as to say that probably nuclear power couldn't have been sold in Japan since the 1950s without the help of the media. And we'll probably get into who played a crucial role in that. But suffice it to say that the media has been a key element in promoting nuclear energy, or at least not covering some parts of it, the worst parts of it.
Brian Covert, let's get into that just a little bit, the history of this, and I believe you're talking about a person that you bring up as a main player here, and you actually call this the Shiriki factor. Could you talk to us, what does that mean? Who is this?
Yes, it's Mr. Matsutaro Shoriki, and he was Japan's first atomic energy commissioner. Actually, he got his start in the media back in the 1920s when he bought out a newspaper called the Yomiuri newspaper, which was kind of a small liberal struggling newspaper in Tokyo. He had been fired from a police post in Tokyo. He was a kind of a high-ranking police official, went out and bought a newspaper, and quickly kind of moved up in the media world. And some years later, Mr. Shoriki with the blessing of the United States, helped to bring U.S. technology to Japan. And again, this was during the Cold War period. And Mr. Shoriki was a staunch Cold Warrior, very anti-communist, very anti-China, and that sounded very good to the United States in the Cold War years. So Mr. Shoriki was a very key person in this whole scenario of how Fukushima came to be. Mr. Shoriki had a dream back then that nuclear power would be brought to every single corner of Japan, and in some senses, his dream did come true, looking back now. Although he's been dead a number of years, and he probably couldn't have foreseen Fukushima coming, he most certainly laid the groundwork for this kind of accident to happen.
Almost.
During his lifetime.
Almost sounds like a William Randolph Hearst meets Eddie Bernays, and plays into the Cold War policies here of the U.S., and certainly General Electric and many of the other nuclear power type industries have benefited from that, and benefited from manipulating the media to generate public support.
Exactly. That's what it is. And He goes a little bit more beyond that. We'll probably get into some other connections that he had with the U.S. government. He was also a person who brought baseball to Japan. So there is that side of it as well. He was good at really kind of selling the public on new things, new fads, and especially if they were pro-American. So the nuclear scenario kind of fit well into that at that time. We're talking about in the Cold War in the 1950s. So yes, it is kind of resembled that kind of situation.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on KPFA Pacifica Radio. I'm Andy Roth. Dan Scythe, I'd like to turn to you. At International MedCom, you've been involved in not only the production of radiation detection instruments, but also the monitoring of radiation in Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, and most recently, of course, in Fukushima. If I understand right, Dan, you're just recently back from Japan. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was over a couple of weeks ago. We had we've been working with a group, a nonprofit group called SafeCast that I'm very, very excited about. It's a international group of people. There's people of all ages, but there's a lot of young people, which is heartening. And the focus up till now has been on collecting and publishing the data, the radiation data in Japan. And the attention is shifting to worldwide right now. It's got the backing of some really important people. There's a team up at MIT Media Lab where Joy Ito, a Japanese man that has helped found SafeCast, is the director. He's the director of the MIT Media Lab. And the data is all published on maps at a website, safecast.org or safecast.jp. And when I started working with this group in April 2011, we started mapping the data, and I could see that as we would go out and collect data and publish it, the government would follow by releasing data. So it was really the actions of these brave citizens that brought a lot of the data out into the public and kind of, I think, pushed foreclosure forward. Yes, I've been involved in other communities. My favorite projects are proactive, preventative projects. I believe that having transparent radiation monitoring in place, you know, can prevent nuclear accidents, because it forces people to look at what they're doing a little more carefully. Maybe you're not going to cut the night shift at the nuclear plant if you know that people outside are monitoring and that your data is going to show up on the World Wide Web in real time. Regarding this media thing, when we were working with the Massachusetts legislature back in, I think it was 89, to put a monitoring system around the Pilgrim nuclear reactor, GE Mark I reactors there as well, the Boston Globe had full page ads by Boston Edison that were touting the efficacy of their TLD system, which is not a real time monitoring system. And, you know, so the media can be a partner, you know, even just innocently, just by taking ads in keeping things from happening that are proactive and protect the public health. And it all goes back to, from my experience, I have family that was downwind from the Nevada test site, and there was a pattern that started back then, which was under the, you know, national security agenda, that people really, you know, didn't need to be informed about risk, or they couldn't understand it. So we're just going to have the experts handle that, and we'll tell people what they need to know. And somehow that paradigm has persisted. It persisted at Chernobyl. It persisted at Three Mile Island. And it persisted at Fukushima. And that's a paradigm I'd like to see change.
So that's quite interesting. The kind of trust us, we're experts paradigm, and SafeCast, this nonprofit, attempting to break the mold on that. You mentioned a moment ago Safecast and other organizations releasing data as collected at Fukushima, and then the government in response releasing data of its own. Could you elaborate on that? My assumption as you say that is the government's data is intended to contradict or dispute the implications of the data released by Safecast. Is that so?
Well, I'm not saying anything negative about the Japanese government here. I'm very conscious when I'm in Japan as an American that we're the country that bombed civilians at Hiroshima and Nagasaki and brought nuclear power to Japan. And it's kind of painful for me to, that awareness. And I'm grateful to Japan. I drive a Honda CRV. The Japanese set this by saying that they could meet the California air quality standards when Detroit said they couldn't. We have cleaner air in America. And I keep telling the Japanese that, I'd like to see them do that for clean tech and green technology, what they did for air quality here in America. But we have to remember that, despite all of the problems and confusion around the data being released or not, they were in the middle of an earthquake that moved Japan 8 feet on the map and shifted the tilt of the Earth's axis. So it wasn't an easy situation to deal with. But I think that if there was a commitment worldwide, for a robust real-time radiation monitoring that's transparent and isn't controlled by authority, maybe it's independent, would be ideally the situation, that the world would be a safer place to live in for now and for future generations.
And I think it's quite interesting, speaking as a sociologist, that you point out that that kind of monitoring implemented in an independent, autonomous sort of way would have not only, as it were, technological consequences, but really social consequences. That, as you mentioned, the possibility that staffing decisions might be made differently with the awareness. So that leads me to ask a two-part question of you then. Could you say more about the monitoring process? And insofar as we have monitoring today, what are we learning from that monitoring?
Okay, well, right now the focus has been on the land. And at first we didn't know anything. And so, I was in April 2011, I was invited to a conference in Tokyo by Joy Ito. It was kind of a remarkable, you've got somebody, I've been coming out of this age of dealing with, problems like this over and over again, where there's really a lack of the technology to support rapid dissemination and a lack of public will, a lack of knowledge. And I found myself on this rooftop in Tokyo that was still swaying, and on this rooftop was the chief technology officer of Twitter, the Ray Ozzie, the CTO of Microsoft after Bill Gates, Joy Ito of MIT Media Lab, one of Google's chief scientists, the president of Evernote. It was all these leaders in the world of the new media and new technologies, and the conference had a theme going on about new technology and the old media. We had the bureau chief and the New York Times there and all the local Japan media present. And the social media, the role of social media was really felt in a large way in the Haiti earthquake and in a LA earthquake. The number of tweets, compared with the pace of the old media in getting information out was compared. So with this group, there a lot of our thought, we're on this rooftop that's been dusted with radioactivity in Tokyo, and we're talking about how to do something, how to make something happen rapidly. And they turned to me, and I was quite humbled by that, but they asked me, you know, what do we need to know, you know, based on your experience? And I felt really in a tough situation, because all of the people who mentored me, John Goffman, Carl Morgan, Alice Stewart, they're all gone now. And but there was, you know, there was a few things that I felt like I could say with confidence, and one was that the most vulnerable people were the first trimester pregnancies, babies, children, young women. They were going to be the most vulnerable, that, you know, time was of the essence, and that the radiation, distribution of the radiation wasn't going to be a uniform pattern. You know, our experience at Chernobyl, for instance, showed places in Sweden where you could go where one side of the street was clean and the other side of the street was not, you know, was pretty hot. And it really gets down to where the wind and the rain take it. And so there was a decision made for rapid deployment. And what we did is we started, all of these bright people put their heads together, Peter Franken and a guy named Akiba from Tokyo Hackerspace. It was a little bit like a Frederick Pohl science fiction novel. All of these people working together and strapping, you know, duct tape and Mylar and Pelican cases and strapping instruments to cars and hacking together software that would log the data. And the first run went up on Easter Sunday. I remember it really clearly. And I was following Peter Franken on his trip up there very closely on Facebook. And these people are very Facebook and some other texting and everything. And got to a school where the children were going to show up for school the next day. It was a kindergarten. And the playground equipment was just firecracker hot. And we got the first data in, and you could see the data on the map. You could see the colors change. And then for the first time, I could see where the plume went. And the next day, the media released the Japan-U.S. Army jointly collected data that showed the same thing. And I kept seeing a pattern of that as SafeCast. And I think this is one of these paradigms that we have to break. There's a feeling that, and it's true that stress is dangerous too. Stress can hurt people, but people want to hold back information to prevent panic and stress. And when people know that information is being held back, that's another form of stress. So I think somehow we got to get past this and just start having data be open. And the SafeCast people, I really, 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 really strongly recommend donations to the organization SafeCast, because I think if anybody is going to be able to break this paradigm, it's going to be this group with the powerful backers behind it in the new media era. And so anybody out there who's thinking about what to do for Christmas, I'd say send money to SafeCast, and maybe we can open things up.
Dan Sith from International MedCom. Let's turn back to you, Brian Covert. And again, your research in Japanese media on the road to Fukushima. We just heard several remarks about media, about the coverage, about the new media and so on. Let's go back a little bit and look. Codename PODAM, and you actually go into this and look at the history of the CIA's past connections to media nuclear power in Japan. And I bring that up today on the 35th anniversary of Carl Bernstein's article in the Rolling Stone on the role of the CIA in the American media and Operation Mockingbird and all the rest. And again, this isn't outlandish conspiracy theory. This is matter of fact historical research that shows these kinds of connections to manipulate media, manipulate the public. Can you talk more about PODAM, and then again maybe wrap that up in through maybe back to your nuclear industrial complex to the Lockheed scandal?
Sure. Mr. Shoriki, who we talked about a little earlier,
had a relationship, not known publicly at the time, with the CIA, and what he was doing was gathering information about, for example, the Japan Communist Party, the persons working in the Japanese media, and feeding that to the CIA. And this wasn't known at the time. It did come out later. He was given the code name by the CIA of PODAM, P-O-D-A-M. Also, another great code name, PoJackpot 1, which shows you that the CIA probably thought it hit gold with Mr. Shoriki, who was Japan's premier media baron at that time. Anyway, as time went on, and Mr. Shoriki went on to found the first TV station, commercial TV station in Japan, there is some evidence to show, and again, this is documented by a professor in Tokyo, that Mr. Shoriki was cooperating with the CIA on that too. So, again, from the inception of nuclear power, using his power with the media, Mr. Shoriki was working very closely with the U.S. And the nuclear power industry itself, essentially. As time went on, that relationship between media and nuclear power has only strengthened, and the nuclear power industry advertises widely in the media today. The nuclear power companies have what they call Kisha clubs or reporters clubs. It's a very systemic type of press club system, which acts essentially as a filtering system for information from the powers that be out to the public. And these Kisha club systems tend to kind of restrict their own reporting. There's a lot of self-censorship in what they write and what they don't write. So, again, this whole thing plays out in today with the fact that there's not a whole lot of tough questioning going on. There hasn't been from the Japanese media, and that's simply because the Japanese media and the nuclear power industry are so close, have always been close. So the legacy of Mr. Shoriki lives on today in the 21st century, and even though he's passed on, the nuclear media industrial complex survives. And what I call for in the chapter in the Project Censored book is for the Japanese media to break that relationship with the nuclear powers that be. And until that happens, I just don't think we're going to get the full story of just how bad the situation is in Fukushima. So we'll have to see how that plays out in the long run, but it doesn't look really positive because the Japanese media is not making any moves away from that at this point.
Brian Covert, an independent journalist in Japan, also a lecturer in media and journalism, contributor to Censored 2013. Thanks again so much for your contributions and ongoing work.
Thank you.
Dan Sith, thanks also for joining us today. I wanted to give you the last brief word just because I believe you're also speaking at Bioneers. Is that correct?
Well, we have a display area over there by the theater at Bioneers. We're going to be there the next few days. We've got some, we're starting to look at food monitoring and, seaweed, fish, things like that. So that's kind of a personal interest of mine, and we're, some other people that are interested in that, people from Fukushima Response and, Peace Roots, and other people are going to be there. And so we're going to be sharing information and learning from other people.
And an online source where people can track your work?
Well, safecast.org is the nonprofit work that we're supporting, one of the groups, the main group we're supporting. Medcom.com is our instrument company. I've got a blog going at geigercounter.com that I'll be updating soon on the Japan trip.
Okay. Thanks very much, Dan, for joining us this morning. We'll certainly be looking to follow up with you in the future.
Okay, thanks. Good to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome.
Take care, everybody out there.
Thanks for joining us, Dan Sith, Brian Covert, also Cecile Pineda and Yastel Yamada. I'm Mickey Huff with Andy Lee Roth in studio. This is Project Censored Morning Mix Show. Special thanks to Kirsten Thomas, who was at all the controls this morning. We couldn't have done it without her. Dr. Peter Phillips will be back with us next week. Also like to thank Peter Phillips for putting together today's program. Also, one announcement, the Project Censored Book Release Party, Censored 2013, will be at Moe's Books on Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, California, Saturday, November 3rd at 7:30 p.m., so we certainly hope to see some of you there. We're out of time today. We'll see you next time.